Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Chris Vandercook is off today. What happens before you die? A chaplain with Pacific Health Ministries tells us why advanced health care directives are important and why none of us should postpone making those important decisions. And you're in for a treat as we take you to the streets to learn more about our Chinatown. Karen Motosui, director of the Hawaii Heritage Center, takes us on a walking tour of a place she knows intimately. It's April 13th, day 10 of our Spring Pledge Drive. Those conversations and a few more right after the news. You're back with The Conversation. End-of-life decisions are best made long before they're needed, when they can be discussed with family members and loved ones. Ruth Peterson is a chaplain with Pacific Health Ministry who's made it her mission to educate people about advanced directives. She talked with my co-host, Chris Vandercook, about their critical importance.
Well, I believe it is incredibly important because devastating injury and illness can happen at any time. Mm-hmm. And advanced healthcare directives are not just for 80 and 90 and 100-year-olds. Mm-hmm. They're for 30 and 40 and 20-year-olds and everyone in between. And it's a way to make sure that your wishes and needs are met when you are no longer able to speak for yourself.
In the event of a catastrophic injury that might, say, leave you brain dead, something like that?
Yes, or in any other ways where your brain just might not be able to make your vocal cords work and you're not able to communicate with the doctors what kind of medical care you wish to receive, if any, mm-hmm. for how much, for how long.
In what kind of areas, what are some of the areas that this breaks down into an advanced directive?
Well, the advanced directive usually speaks about what type of pain management you would want. It talks about whether you wish to be on a breathing machine or a feeding tube, if you want to die at home or if you want to die at the hospital, if you want your family to know everything that is happening or if that is something private that you wish to keep. And most importantly, it designates what is called a healthcare advocate. An important point to make is that an advance directive is different from a living will, which we used to talk about a lot.
Yeah.
Because a living will, by and large, is not, in my understanding, in the state of Hawaii, legally binding. Uh-huh. But an advance health care directive is something that is legally binding and that the healthcare institutions will respect and honor.
Now, that's not a distinction that many people understand. I certainly never heard of that before.
No, and we use the terms interchangeably. I myself have used the terms interchangeably. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to something this important, it's important that we use the right terms.
So an advance directive is an official state document? Or
it is an official state document. It looks like this.
Okay. Hawaii Advance Healthcare Directive. Now, you got this on... online?
You can get it online. You can go to your doctor's office. Any of them would have them. You mm-hmm. can print it off of any number of websites. Kakua Mau usually has these available, which is a good website for people who are starting to look. And this does not have to be notarized. It can just be witnessed, and it is legal and binding. And once you complete it, you place it in your doctor's files. Perhaps you have it on file with the hospital that you're likely to go to, but you keep a copy. Mm-hmm. Your loved ones have copies. Your medical representative has a copy so that
Ruth,
when it comes.
I'm going to just sort of walk you through it by categories. I'm sure you're very familiar with these, but healthcare power of attorney is part one, designation of agent. That makes sense. And then part two is individual instructions broken down into end-of-life decisions. Things like, I want to stop or withhold medical treatment that would prolong my life. Pretty intense kind of thinking called for
to deal with
these questions.
It is. And there's another legal document that is also very intense and very intimidating.
Uh-huh.
It's called a POLST, or Provider Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
Uh-huh.
It's, as you see, the Advanced Healthcare Directive is multi-page. This is one page.
Yeah.
And this is for people who have been diagnosed with a serious illness, perhaps within the last year of their life.
Mm-hmm.
It's typically on bright green paper. You stick it to the refrigerator so that when the ambulance workers come, they can take it with them. You should also, though, give a copy to your mandated advocate.
This has a category, for example, do not attempt, attempt resuscitation, CPR. Do not attempt resuscitation.
Exactly.
CPR.
And this, unlike the advanced healthcare directive, the POLST needs to be filled out in the presence of your doctor and signed by your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it is legal in that
signature
way.
Signature of provider.
Exactly. But yeah. Before you get to these documents, which can be overwhelming and
yeah.
intimidating.
It's kind of where you come in is before you fill these
out,
right?
Exactly. There are some tools that are very useful to get you to the point where you're able to answer these in an easy way.
Right.
There are a couple out there that I like, and some people prefer using one, some people prefer using the other.
Uh-huh.
The first one is something called the Conversation Project.
Uh-huh.
And again, you can go online. It's a free form. It's pretty
uh-huh.
when you print it out. And it is a tool that you can use to sit with your family, your loved ones, those who will have to make those decisions for you. And it has questions like, finish the sentence. What matters to me at the end of life is.
Wow.
And then there's a space for you to put it down. But there are also prompts. As a patient, I would like to know on one end only the facts and on the other end all the details
mm-hmm.
or somewhere in between. So if you sit with your loved ones and you go through this, as I have with my loved ones,
mm-hmm.
it helps get a sense of what really is important so that when you go to the more concrete legal forms, it makes it much easier. The other tool that a lot of people use is called Five Wishes.
Mm-hmm.
That also can be found on the internet, can be found through Kukua Mau. Of course, there's a $5 charge for Five Wishes, and the Conversation Project is free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just which you find easier to use.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of dealing with questions, asking yourself questions like this, involves going to, as we said, it's a very, very troubling place. And as we've gone over some of these things that you're asked to consider, again and again, it comes back to me that you'd be post a catastrophe, you'd be in no position to make these decisions. You're
yes.
just in no shape to decide any
and
of those things. Do it when you're, you know,
when you're feeling
and
good
and
clear-headed
right.
and when you have time to go and talk with people.
Exactly.
Studies show that between the years, the New England Journal of Medicine posted a study between 2000 and 2006 of almost 4,000 deaths in one area of the country.
Mm-hmm.
They considered that representative of all the deaths in the United States
mm-hmm.
that year. Almost 45% of the people who died were unable to speak for themselves, and yet decisions had to be made
wow.
at their bedside. The worst possible place to try to make these decisions is when an accident has happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was over 30 years ago in my own family, and one of my father's aunties had been living alone, completely healthy, relatively young, only in her 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And she was found unresponsive in her home. And when we arrived at the ICU, the doctor came in and explained the situation, explained that she was not likely to recover, and said, so you need to tell us what you want us to do. I'll be back in 15 minutes for your answer. And never having discussed that,
yeah.
we were left to say, well, what do we think Auntie would want? And if we had talked with her before about this.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have to say, what do we think? We would be able to say, well, I know that Auntie or Uncle or Mom or my sister wants this
yeah.
and does not want that.
Well, it's an enormous comfort to those left behind to be able to say, we talked about this.
And then people that I've talked with have come to me and said, this has been such a gift because my mother right now is able to talk with me because we have a great ability to have a conversation, but there's a point where she can no longer talk to me, but we have this as a foundation upon which to build
mm-hmm.
what we will do in her last days.
Now, Ruth, you're a chaplain, so tell me what your work is here. How do you come in?
Well, I'm a chaplain with Pacific Health Ministry, and I'm currently serving at Pohainani Good Samaritan Society in Kaneohe.
Mm-hmm.
Pacific Health Ministry has been around. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary.
Uh-huh.
And we employ about 20 staff chaplains in over 20 facilities around the state on three different islands.
Mm-hmm.
All of us have different areas in which we work. Majority are in hospitals. If you have been hospitalized in the last 30 years in any of the hospitals in the state, odds are you have met
one of you folks,
a Pacific Health Ministry chaplain. Our role as chaplain is not to tell the patients what they think or what they should do. They have a lot of people willing to do that. Our role,
Probably more than enough.
Our role as chaplains is to listen, to help bring forth from them, to be able to speak, perhaps for the first time, their own values and beliefs, what they hold important, and then help them give voice to that in an atmosphere that can be very daunting and hard to live with.
That was Chris Vandercook talking with Ruth M. Peterson. She's a chaplain with Pacific Health Ministry who has served at Good Samaritan Society Pohainani for the last 5 years. Monday is National Healthcare Decisions Day. You can learn more on our Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative, Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working, and iDoctors Hawaii.
Jerry Lopez is one of the legends of big wave surfing, a pioneer in riding some of the world's largest and most dangerous waves. His skills gave him a leg up when he left Hawaii and took on a new sport, snowboarding. He fell in love with it and began incorporating surfing techniques into surfing's snow-based cousin. At Oregon's Mount Bachelor, Jerry created a surf-inspired snowboarding event called the Jerry Lopez Big Wave Challenge. The Big Wave Challenge uses natural and man-made snow-covered mimics some of Jerry's favorite waves from Hawaii and around the world. That event takes place today and tomorrow in Bend, Oregon, and my co-host, Chris Vandercook, spoke with him about his new passion ahead of last year's event.
Well, you know, it's a lot like surfing. I went one time, it was actually my wife's idea, and she loves to tell the story about how I stood there, and yeah, another one of your big ideas. But for actually both of us, it was one of those things that, you know, it was love at first bite, and in fact, we ended up moving lock, stock, and barrel. Well, you know, it was a process of several years from Maui to Oregon here so that we could snowboard more.
I would imagine the first thing that was strange about it was that the surface is not moving beneath you, right?
Well, that's actually one of the great things about it. You know, after a lifetime in the ocean chasing waves, that's really one of the beauties about snowboarding is that the mountain holds still for you while, you know, you take your ride out there in the ocean. Everything's moving.
And when you're on the ocean, you've got to have a sort of a human springboard ready to move with it, right? I would think that would be a big adjustment.
Well, you know, that's why surfing is such a great metaphor for life, because life doesn't hold still for us either. And all the things you learn out in the surf, trying to be, as you say, spontaneous, you know, and moving with it is just what you have to do with life, too. And if you don't, it just passes you right by.
Yeah, that's a few would disagree with that, Jerry. At the same time, you know, I would think that whole sort of resilience that you need for surfing would be quite a bit of an adaptation when you don't have to move with the surface. Is it a lot easier then?
In some ways it is, but, you know, there are all the little things about snowboarding and the snow and the mountains that need to be, learned again. So there's you know, nothing easy about anything in life. Mm-hmm. It's all a process.
How long did it take you to learn, you to get comfortable snowboarding?
Well, let's put it this way. I brought one of my surf team riders up, you know, one of the really hotshot young surfers, and he learned, I mean, really learned in about an hour.
Yeah.
It took me quite a bit longer than he did, but snowboarding compared to surfing is something that most surfers, you know, when they first try it, discover that it's actually something that comes very naturally, and they are able to pick it up pretty quickly, at least pick it up to the level where they're having a good time doing it.
Mm-hmm. Are the competitors in events like your Big Wave Challenge, are they do they come from surfing, or are they lifelong snowboarders, native snowboarders, if you will?
Well, here in Oregon, most of the people that live here are, you know, winter enthusiasts who embrace the snow. And, yeah, a lot of them are hotshot snowboarders. So this is the reason that we have what I call a pro surfer division in our event, where we can get the surfers, you know, hopefully from Hawaii or anywhere, mm-hmm. to come. And they may not be, you know, totally comfortable and maybe feel a little bit out of their element. So they have their own division, and they can just go against the other surfers and not be intimidated by guys who have spent the whole winter chasing the snow.
Yeah. Are there a lot of surfers adapting to snowboarding?
I think all surfers at some point give it a try.
Really?
They do, yeah, because they hear so often, you know, and I'm one of the big advocates of it, that it really, especially in powder snow, is so much like surfing. And the whole idea of this event, well, it came about because, you know, the wind blows the snow and creates these snow features that we call wind lips that look just like waves on the ocean, except they're frozen, you know. They're, mm-hmm. They're made out of snow. And they kind of happen in the same places on the mountain. And so I've named a lot of them after, you know, surf spots that I'm familiar with. And I was talking with Ben. He was the marketing director of the Mount Bachelor ski area here. And he goes, well, we should have an event that kind of like a snow surfing event, you know, and we kind of brainstormed it a little bit and came up with this idea that, well, we could build waves out of snow and judge it like a surf contest.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we have.
As a surfer, you were pretty familiar with the challenges, the particular challenges of huge waves, right?
Well, I like them all, but yeah, bigger waves are always a little more challenging, and I think I really like those better.
Well, you know, to the novice, it looks like somebody, you know, roller skating down a two-story building or something, and I'm wondering how you duplicate that on snow.
Well, you get on a big slope and imagine that it's a wave that's holding still for you, and away you go.
And in a way that you probably, at various times over your career, might have wished that some of those waves would hold still, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they never do they?
Well, apparently not. But so a lot of the designs sort of came out of your own experience as a surfer, it sounds like, the way you designed the course on Mount Bachelor.
Yeah, and we name each of the features that we build after a surf spot. You know, surf spots that I'm familiar with or that I wish I was familiar with, you know, just from seeing pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you know, adds a little more of a surf element to this snow event.
Well, Jerry, how has your cold weather adaptation been? That's something people from Hawaii are always concerned about.
Well, I tell you what, I think you can be dressed more warmly in any of the snow conditions than you ever can in the surf conditions. And I think I've been more cold and miserable surfing in Hawaii on a north wind day than I've ever been up on the mountain.
And that was Mr. Pipeline himself, Hawaii's own Jerry Lopez. He is a big wave surfer and the creator of the Jerry Lopez Big Wave Challenge. That event is being held today and tomorrow at Mount Bachelor in Bend, Oregon. You can find a link to the event on the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, a student-focused literacy platform committed to providing relevant new nonfiction content to engage students at their reading level. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
Not too long ago, we got to take part in a walking tour of historic Chinatown. We tagged along with AARP members as part of a series of events sponsored by the organization. It's a popular tour regularly offered through the Hawaii Heritage Center. Longtime volunteer director Karen Motosui gave our group a VIP tour. Take a listen. We're here in Chinatown on a walking tour. The sights and sounds in this neighborhood come alive through the eyes of someone who grew up on these streets.
So you always know you're in Chinatown because only in Chinatown do the signs have the Chinese character that says North Hotel Street. Then the other thing about these signs is they have all of the colors very important for the Chinese culture. One, the most noticeable you see is the gold.
Gold for prosperity, red for good luck, and green for nature. The tour takes us to a Shinto shrine where we stop by a fountain for cleansing.
Okay, everybody, just stand around this water thing here. Everybody, just stand right around because you need to purify yourselves.
And then we head up the stairs to the temple entrance.
What you have to do is to awaken the gods, you move it in a circular direction. Just to say, gods, I have arrived.
And we stop at old-time family eateries for manapua and pork hash, and another Chinese favorite, matai su, a sweet and savory treat that I'm not familiar with, but it's good.
Okay, so this family, Chahutsat, the Mao family, they are rare. They're one of less than five families where they're able to pass the business on to the next generation. So when we go in there, you will see Mrs. Mao, because she answered the phone this morning when I said, I need 65 matai su. And she answered the phone, and she's in her 90s.
It's another dimension to Chinatown that adds to the richness of the neighborhood.
I grew up in a Chinese camp in Chinatown, and we grew up, our parents always said, you know, the Chinese are really smart with money. So we used to sing this ditty. It goes like this. Ching chong, Chinaman sitting on the fence, trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. You know that. You know that, right? Okay, so really, they could make a dollar out of 15 cents. They were so good with money.
But wait, I hadn't heard that schoolyard ditty before. Can you say that children's limerick again? The one you were...
Oh!
How does it go?
Ching chong, Chinaman sitting on the fence, trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents.
And that's not too far off from the story of the Chinatown Heritage Center and what Matasui is trying to do. She needs to raise $3 million to build a new home.
We know it's going to cost us at least $3 million to build our new home on Smith Street on property we've owned for actually over 20 years. So if you donate $1 million, we will put your name on the building. We desperately need a new home because over 25 years ago, we did have to start an archives program due to the Oahu Market family donation of artifacts going back to the 1800s. And that family donated over 1,000 pieces from their family collection.
That's a fabulous gift.
Yeah, that is. Because that collection includes one of the young family's sons who went to China and brought back to Hawaii Cantonese opera. So we have all these Cantonese opera clothing that they wore on stage, musical instruments, the music, footwear, headgear, everything from that those Cantonese operas that was performed in Hawaii.
And you have some of these costumes and props here at the Heritage Center, but you'd like to have a permanent home to properly display them and share the history of Chinatown.
Right, right. So, you know, once people found out that we had an archives, and I have to tell you, we're very poor. We have no website. We have no brochure. We don't even have a sign on the sidewalk. But Hawaii is small. People find out what we do here. So we did receive a donation of the English language newspapers going back to 1850 plus 100 years. So it's 1850 to 1950. And these are the only existing hard copy newspapers left. So that came to us. We did not ask for it. We were asked to keep this because none of the archives in Hawaii 15, 20 years ago had space. And the collection was ready to be shipped off to Washington, D.C. So we have that. That's probably a very valuable collection. So we desperately need that archives because that those newspapers have to be stored. Another extremely valuable collection we have, because all our collection is unique here in Hawaii, in the United States, in the whole world. We also have the artifacts dug up in Chinatown from all the high-rises. Now, those archaeological services cost over $1 million, and what they produced was over 500,000 pieces dug up. And we have some in the gallery on display, but there the collection is now dispersed at different storage sites. There's 30 pieces in the gallery. What the collection shows is who lived in Chinatown 200, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, 100 years ago. So they represent Europeans. Of course, they also represent Hawaiians. Like, there's a poi pounder that is a Kauai poi pounder because every island made their poi pounder a little different. So we have an example of a Kauai poi pounder. So there are Hawaiian artifacts, European artifacts, and Chinese, and artifacts representing really the people who transited Chinatown over the last 200 years.
Right, so these were buried treasures that are now in your possession, and again, you would love to be able to display them and preserve them for the future generations because it's really wonderful Hawaii history.
Right, that's right. So we that's why we really need our new building because one floor would be devoted to the archives, and then we could bring in all of the collections that have been donated to Heritage Center. We do get a lot of requests, especially for the newspapers. I mean, I've had LA Times come in and just say, here's $100. Can you give me the front page of this certain date? But all of our collections right now are not accessible, not open to the public, because we don't have the right facility and we don't have the staffing. And hopefully once we get the building built, the archives itself, like the Heritage Center programs, would become self-sustaining. In other words, people come into the gallery, they pay $1, they go on the Chinatown tour, they donate $30. So if they use the archives, they make a donation and, you know, they can. So we're kind of set up to be a self-sustaining program, but we do need that building. The other thing is that in our gallery, you will find less than 5% of our total historic interpretive exhibits. 95% and over are all in storage. And so we would like to bring out more of these exhibits representing the Germans, the Scots, the Irish, the Filipinos, all those different groups, the Greeks that, number one, transited Chinatown as they moved off of the plantation, but also contributed to Hawaii's growth and development in their own way. I mean, people don't know that the building in Makalei is Greek. That's a Greek name at the corner of King and McCulley Street. I think it's called the Cronus Building. And then we also have a lot of very significant buildings. So, you know, we want to be able to preserve as much of the history of all of these groups that came to Hawaii from the plantation era till today. Like, we just got donations of Cambodian artifacts. And some of them, there are a couple of pieces that came to us straight from Cambodia. But we've had pieces donated by Cambodians that they brought to Hawaii, and they're living here. They're a very small community, but again, what people don't know is these Cambodians are hard workers, they're farmers, they're also making their contribution to Hawaii's growth and development. So they're a recent group, but we would like to also encourage those recent arriving groups to also preserve their history so that today and in the future, people will know how Hawaii came to be the great state that it is today.
Right. And so you have these tours, and so it helps to sustain the center for the short term. But again, if anyone's out there listening and would like to help you find a permanent home, you need them.
Yes, we do need the... We only exist because of public support. We don't receive any funding from the city or the state or the federal government for our general operations. Those are strictly donations coming in to Heritage Center, and we wouldn't be able to survive without them. You know, we're really here for the long term, so that people have a place to come to learn about the history, the experiences, and the contributions of all of these immigrant groups that came to Hawaii.
Near the end of the tour, we stroll past the tables of older Chinese men gambling openly along the River Street Promenade, the Sun Yat-sen Mall, trying their darndest to make a dollar out of 15 cents. Out and about in Chinatown, this is Catherine Cruz.